Because adversity is often the breeding ground for development. Dive into neurointerventional stories, the uncensored interviews. Our guests, all leaders in the field of neurointervention, share the difficulties they face, the complications they have had to manage, and speak without filters on little discussed, sometimes controversial, or simply taboo subjects. Hello, my name is Nantia Sujijantrarat, and today I am pleased to welcome Dr. Francisco Montalvern for this new episode of INR Stories. Dr. Montalvern, welcome.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It should be a pleasure.
Dr. Montalvern, can you briefly introduce yourself and your path in a few words?
When I was 17, I moved from a poor region in Brazil to São Paulo to make my med school. And after that, I made my specialization on neurology. And I was not so motivated with the way we treated patients, and I was very prone to more challenging cases in the ER, mainly vascular disease. And that's why I moved to interventional radiology field. And I started studying French, and I came to Paris to train. And I trained here for 4 years. In fact, 1 year in Paris and 3 years in the University of Strasbourg. And then I made my PhD co-direction with São Paulo University and Paris University. I have been working with interventional radiology for 23 years, and I'm very happy with that, mainly because I have been helping a lot of people in my country and also multiplying the knowledge that I have acquired through an education program that I have been building with some friends in the Brazilian Society of Neuroradiology.
So your career is very unique. You know, this podcast is titled INR Stories, the Uncensored Interview. So we are going to delve into topics that are not talked about much. And, you know, we often focus on success stories, but what interests us today is the difficulties and the complications that you've had to face. And so I will go into the first question. What would you say, just broadly, are the biggest professional difficulties you've had to face?
I would say that the first difficulty I had was to start my own career alone, because I could not share challenging situations. And I would not advise to anybody, because, you know, the weight of having a complex case, the decision-making process, and chiefly the leading with complication, is not easy. So I do advise young practitioners nowadays to try to start their own life with some support, at least remote, you know, one of the masters that they had, try to discuss and share difficult situations. It's quite important.
Have you had to overcome personal difficulties in pursuing your profession?
When I quit France, I was 30 years old. So I came to my city that I have left when I was 17, as I mentioned before. So I have no medical network. Although, I mean, I came from a family that has a lot of doctors, I haven't built personal network. So I stayed home for 6 months. And at that time, my wife got a little bit depressed with that, because we have studied a lot and we had no income, you know. So it's quite funny also, because we shared the room that he used when she was single. You know, so we were using just one bed, you know, and we lived in this situation for 2 years. And for her was more difficult, because all the problems, she handled it. Take me a while to start have my own activity and to earn some money to move. So at that time, we were studying. As I mentioned, we were in the PhD. She was doing a PhD here in France as well. So we had to save a lot of money to travel here, you know. So every money we could save, we spent coming to France. So it took us a while to have economical stability. At that beginning was not easy. What I would suggest for the young people now is just not to be, you know, to motivated to have a practice, you know. So when I left there, in a psychological perspective, I was quite well, because I said, well, I know that I'm going to have nothing. So it depends on where you fix the bar of your happiness. So my bar was very low. So it's a good advice.
It's all about expectation, right?
Yes, all about expectations.
Just out of curiosity, what do you use for a thrombectomy in Brazil, usually?
Yes, it's interesting. It's important to understand that Brazil, we have two realities in a healthcare perspective. You have the public health system. It's about 85% of the population have an access, use it exclusively. And 15% of the population use a private healthcare system. For a private healthcare system, you are treated just like you were in Paris, you know? Mm-hmm. The same device, most of the device you use in Europe, you use in Brazil. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it takes there's a lag of opportunity when a device is available here. It takes us sometime 1 year, but in general, we can use most of the device we have. Mm-hmm. But in the public health system, it's not really the case, because we are struggling for the budget we have to buy materials. That's the main problem.
Have you ever encountered an ethical dilemma in your practice?
That's an easy question.
Yeah.
Because I face this kind of question every day. Let me tell you one situation, and I would like to make this question for you. How would you do it? In Brazil, we have a problem in the public health system with the reimbursement of the mechanical thrombectomy devices. So we have nowadays just 5 hospitals in Brazil. I would like to remind you that Brazil is a 230 million population country. You know, it's a lot of patients, a lot of people, and we have just 5 hospitals that perform mechanical thrombectomy. So my center is one of them. Even though I'm happy to be part of this very selective group, I know that I'm facing a lot of difficulties every day. Why? Because I have the budget to treat just 15 patients per month, around 15 patients, you know? And we receive about 2,000 ischemic stroke patients per year. So we perform around 550 IV TPA per year. And it's easy to see that I would have at least 30 patients per month that would be a good candidate according to current guidelines for ischemic stroke treatment through endovascular route. And at the beginning of the month, it's not complex to make the choice. But when you know that you have just 15 packages to treat patients, you start to be selective, you know? So if you have an elderly patient where you know, should I treat this patient or not? Because the next patient may not be treated, you know? And the next patient would be a 15-year-old girl or boy. And this kind of dilemma is difficult. For me, it's difficult. I discussed with the team and the interventional radiology team, and we have decided not to select them because I cannot solve administrative problem, right? If I select the patient in the emergency department, the administrative board will not be aware of the problem. Yeah. So we have decided to follow the guidelines. If the patient is previously independent, have a small ischemic core, and have a proximal occlusion, we will treat it then consecutively. Mm-hmm. And once the device are finished, they are finished, mm-hmm. and it's not my problem anymore to select patients, you know? So I try to transfer the problem for the person who can solve. I could not solve this problem. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to say that I'm not going to be part of the solution. Of course, I want to be part of the solution, but I don't have the tools to solve the problem. This is quite difficult ethical dilemma that I wouldn't like you to have.
That's a really difficult question to solve. So actually, this transitions nicely into the next segment, which is patient care in particular country. I think you've covered really well one of the most problematic issue in the field in your country. Now, in your opinion, in what areas should your country focus on in terms of health policy and regulation in healthcare?
It's a quite tough question. What I think is that in a modern perspective, a doctor is supposed to be also a lawyer for healthcare, trying to defend the best scientific options for the patients in a cost effectiveness perspective as well, because they are different issues. And what we try to do is first increase the number of well-educated interventional radiologists in Brazil through educational program. And we have organized a competence-based curriculum that are focused not only on knowledge, but also on the skills. And we are supposed through that to increase a pathway of excellence toward a better assistance. And that's why most of the Brazilians nowadays are trained in our country, you know, in our own training centers. But besides, we have also, through our Brazilian society, implemented a grant to students to make observership abroad. And this is a partnership with French society. And through that, we try to pick some interventional radiologists to maintain the excellence pathway and to have some output from developed countries. This is one part that is, I think, a mainstay of sustainability of the access for treatment, mainly when we look into the perspective of ischemic stroke treatment. Mm-hmm. You know, that you know there is a stroke burden, mm-hmm. and we as interventional radiologists, we are part of the solution, but we are not sometimes enough, and we are not placed in the good positions, in the good regions to treat patients. Mm-hmm. And that is another perspective that I would like to show you, that we have not only prepared a curriculum to train interventional radiologists, but also we have tried to spread the number of training centers in areas that there was a low density of interventional radiology, mainly in the north of the country. Because for your understanding, about 70% of the interventional radiology are in the south, around São Paulo and Rio. And 30% are around the country. So we have enough practitioners, but they are concentrated in big cities. If you want them to move for other cities, other regions, the best solution is to implement a training center there and try to pick somebody that is from this region and then transform him in a competent interventional radiologist. This is another facet of the solution that we have been trying to find for the interventional radiology assistance in Brazil. The other term of the equation is a regulation, as you mentioned. And through that, we must have a political discussion, because even though the Brazilian constitution offers the right for the access of their healthcare for everybody in Brazil, we don't have the budget to treat everybody. So I personally have been involved in that through the society and alone in my region, try to show to the stakeholders, to decision-making persons, that we should move to the choice of treatment based on cost effectiveness. If you don't have enough money, you should choose some treatments based on one variable. And the variable, I think, is cost effectiveness. Mm-hmm. So that's a work that we have been doing in Brazil. But you know, when you move from the healthcare to the politics, it's a challenge, you know, mm-hmm. because the motivation is not the same. And you should be aware of that. You should not face them. You should try to find a common field. And through this common field, convincing them that it's important also to look at this problem. Mm-hmm. and try to solve the problem.
So that actually kind of answered the second question that I have. I was going to ask, how do you feel the research should focus in your country? And it sounds like cost effectiveness is really one thing that would help to answer some of the more urgent questions, which is that especially in ischemic stroke, when the indications are expanding so rapidly, you're going to have more and more problems with having to choose who you're treating, because all of them, or most of them, are going to end up qualifying at one point.
That's true. We cannot win this run against a disease. I mean, nowhere in the world. Mm-hmm. It's a cliche, but we know that the solution is prevention, you know? Of course, prevent AVM formation or cerebral aneurysm formation is not the focus here, but many for ischemic disease, ischemic stroke, the mainstay is prevention. And I'm part of a joint commission in my state, because we are a federal state just like U.S. And we are organizing a training in schools, because it's easier to create a new world through the children than to change old habits in adults, you know? And that's the way I think we should go. And of course, for the diseases that are already in place, And for the population that cannot be prevented, of course, the decision should be focused on cost effectiveness, not only in efficacy.
So we're going to move into the last part of the podcast. We're going to take a journey through time. Let's say we go back 10 to 15 years. Was there anything that you would do differently in your career?
No. I'm not very prone to regret the decision I have made. I don't like the decision I have not made. So when I am active in the decision-making process, I feel very comfortable. And personally, I would not change anything in my journey. I would do everything the same way. And I had the opportunity to stay in France. It would be very comfortable to stay here. I decided to go to Brazil, and I had the opportunity to go to my med school in São Paulo. São Paulo is just like Brazil and California, you know? So it's, you know, the rich region. It's, everything is easier than the rest of the country. I had the opportunity to follow a career as a professor there, and I decided to move to the Northeast. In fact, my wife decided it, but, you know, it's okay like that. As I mentioned, she's a lawyer. And
she's very convincing.
It's fun because she just asked me, listen, I said her in the last year when I was in Paris, listen, as you know, I have a position in São Paulo, so we are going to go there next year. And she said, well, oh, I'm very happy that you have many friends there and that people love you, but I would like just to make you one question. Would you think it would be easier for me to adapt it to São Paulo, or for you that has a origin in the same city I have, to try to come back to your city? And I said, of course, the easiest decision is to come back to my city. So as I mentioned, we'll come back in 1 year to our city. So that was like that. And you know, for me, when I arrived there, it was not easy at all, because we have discussed this. It took me a while to have a place. It was around 3 to 4 years. But I'm very happy because, you know, I could spread the specialty over there. I could increase the opportunity of people. I'm a quite social person. I mean, I try to think in a collective way. And I think I could multiply the opportunities I had through the educational program, through the assistance, through the training center that we have created there. So I'm very happy with what I've been doing.
Very good. And if we fast forward 15 to 20 years, where do you think our field will be?
Definitely, we cannot fight against technology. Technology should be an ally. I think that we will be like in a cockpit of an airplane. Always thought like that. It was funny because we can see a booth that is just like that here. But I have been thinking a lot like that, because we take a lot of decision based on impression. And sometimes we have the gut feeling that's in general a good impression that's based on our data bank, but it takes a while to have this, you know? And for example, let's take the mind of Professor Mohé, the mind of Laurent Sperl, the variables that they use to decide and try to translate it in an algorithm that would help young practicing to decide. Mm-hmm. You know, definitely, it should be another world. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that we will start to talk to machines, not only talk, but we have a common language with the machines. And we have robotics, and robotics can be a very useful technology, mainly to treat patients remotely. When you take into consideration realities like my country and even poorest countries, that they know they don't have an access for the treatment for elective case, not even talking about urgent case, stroke and ruptured aneurysm, we can definitely multiply the opportunities for many people. And I think it's our duty as blessed people to try to offer equal opportunities to everybody. And once we don't have this, we have not finished our journey.
So you think perhaps the solution to not enough people in the outlier places in the country would be perhaps robotic and
I think so, because it's, if you consider learning curve, you consider complication rates, you consider cost effectiveness, you know, of course, if you have a more experienced guy, it will be easier for the treatment. And mainly, if you analyze it through the lens of the ischemic stroke world, the patient is not going to choose the place they have a stroke, right? So it's easier to be close to them than close to us.
Yeah.
So my personal opinion is that definitely we should work with technology to multiply the opportunities to try to move the future toward equity in terms of access for healthcare.
Very well said. What do you think we're not saying or doing enough for the future neuroradiologist or any interventional person?
It's an easy question. I think we don't really have a plan to train. People learn in most of the training center worldwide through the modeling, copying what the master does. And that's not good. We have discussed it this morning about the pilot training, you know, and they have standards. I think we should have a worldwide training program that would set steps for the treatment. You should define clearly what would be the hardcore of the training, because, you know, in a two-year training, you are not supposed to understand AVM, for example. I'm not saying to treat. So we should, first of all, define what are the competences for interventional radiology in a two-year training program. That, I would say, it will be the hardcore for the treatment. And we should define clearly the knowledge necessary to be competent in this subject, the skills required, in other words, how to apply the knowledge to do something, and the attitude to do so, you know? Because we are dealing with humans in such a fragile situation. And sometimes I have made a lot of mistakes like that. I keep on doing them, fortunately. I realize that I made mistakes. Mm-hmm. And that we, as I mentioned before, that the power that we receive, in fact, they don't give us only powers, you know, they give us responsibilities. So if we are able to treat somebody, if you know, when you have a power, you should make the life of the other easier. Mm-hmm. And you should not consider yourself, I mean, a hero or somebody more important than the other. But unfortunately, we don't work like that. And it's clear that in the training, we don't work this facet of the training. I mean, how to deal with difficult situations, how to lead a team, and how to talk to persons like persons, you know. And I think we should also use simulation more often. And it's not fair to offer a patient for a young practitioner to learn to treat a cerebral aneurysm. It's easier to imagine that we could not take a plane with a pilot that have never traveled a transatlantic flight alone, you know. Yeah. So as a consequence of that, we are not supposed to offer the same situation for young interventional radiologists. So I think we should focus on a clear curriculum with national standard based on each social reality. Mm-hmm. And through this curriculum, we should ensure that most of the training center would have at least a medium level of formation for the trainees. And we are obliged to use simulators for the training. And I would not advise young practitioners to perform procedure without training before in virtual simulation.
Very interesting indeed. So we have discussed several difficult and controversial topics. So we're going to end on a little bit of a positive note. Was there any initiative, person, advancements, any technological inventions that has most inspired you or impressed you in the recent months or recent decades?
I think the great revolution, the greatest revolution, is education. Through this, we can transform realities. In my opinion, all kind of simulations are very important to the safety of patients, not only for the experimented interventional radiologists, but also for the training. So we as older INRs, we should try to offer the trainees a plan of training with a step-by-step way to do it, because it's important to realize that when you or me, we perform a procedure, we are in the automatic model. It's just like when you play tennis, the sportist men or girls, they sometimes they choke and they freeze. They cannot perform quite well. In fact, the psychology behind that, is that when we choke, we try to rationalize what we are doing. So in the same way, when we are performing a procedure, the experiment professional, we are in the automatic model. Mm. So you cannot copy what I'm doing because you do not understand. So we press through all the steps very quickly, and you cannot follow because you understand nothing, you know? You are ignorant at the beginning, and you are ignorant and unconscious. So we should try to show you the steps to treat, to make you realize, to make you conscious that there is a way to do, there is knowledge and how to do it. Mm-hmm. And then you become a clever person and conscious of what you should do. Mm-hmm. This, for me, would be the biggest revolution we can offer to the future of our field, because we can multiply opportunities and we can have more equity. You know, with the device, we cannot have this, you know, because it will be based on the learning curve of operators. It will be based on the access to the technology. But education, we can offer it to everybody.
Thank you very much, Dr. Montalvern, for answering all of our questions today.
It was a pleasure. Hope you can use this discussion to shed some light in the journey of the young practitioner and try not to make our faults and learn with our faults and to become better than us. That's my hope.
Thank you.